What is the history behind the China-Philippines standoff in the South China Sea, and how is the United States involved? What could be the consequences for the West, and particularly the United States, if China maintains its control over vital naval and land routes, like the planned One Belt, One Road project? Is a convergence between China, Russia, and Iran hurting the U.S.? How critical is the overthrow of the Houthis in Yemen to U.S. hegemony in the region? What should one read into the popularity of Marie Le Pen's hard right positions on the EU and migrant policy during the French elections? On this week's Global Research News Hour, our focus is on some of the forces surrounding the major hotspots around the globe. Our guests include political studies professor Radhika Desai and author and geopolitical analyst Mahdi Nazemroya. On this week's program, Flashpoints 2017, South China Sea, Yemen, and beyond. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 21st, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. During this period of quote-unquote peace, the United States has played the role of major hegemonic world power. During this period of quote-unquote peace, the United States has been engaged in vicious conflict in North Korea and Vietnam, has decimated Iraq, Libya, and Afghanistan, and is in the process of trying to complete its work in Syria. It has 700 military bases, replete with 170 golf courses in 170 countries, and its nuclear warheads on the borders of Russia are targeting key Russian cities. However, quote-unquote peace advocates might argue there was no war between the major powers. That comes from the article Endgame, The War Machine Goes On, part 4 of a 6-part essay by Arthur D. Robbins, posted April 20th. The government should make radical decisions and seek ways to deal with this new reality of Erdogan's theocratic ambitions for the Islamization of Hellenic Cyprus. Only the Archbishop of Cyprus dared to speak openly about those fears, but nobody takes him seriously. As for most of the inglorious Cypriot politicians, well, that's another story. While other superpowers offer lip service and fail to support Cyprus, Russia offers the only hope on the table for protecting the island against such dictators. Certainly not the EU or the UN, not while most member states support Turkey. That comes from the article Cyprus and the Death of Democracy in Turkey by Andreas C. Chrysaphis, posted April 20th. Today, April 19th, 2017, is the 22nd anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. The bombing of the Federal Murrah office building was blamed by federal authorities on a bomb made from fertilizer inside a truck parked in front of the building by Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. There are many anomalies associated with the official explanation, including mysterious deaths of some, including a police officer, who understood that the actual facts did not accord with the explanation. Investigators who report the actual facts are branded conspiracy theorists and dismissed. This has been the deep state's way of controlling explanations since the 1940s. That comes from the article, The Oklahoma City Bombing After 22 Years, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted April 20th. The suggestion from the late Emma Morano, who recently passed at a venerable 117 years, being supposedly the only confirmed and recorded centurion remaining from 1899, was one of humble egg consumption. The diet was simple, though eventually losing one's teeth helped to move one away from more complex solids. Morano's death caused the usual springs to come into play. Diet was discussed, forms of lifestyle were considered, anti-aging mechanisms were pored over and devoured. The modern class of wizardry, nutritionists, were eager to make their views felt. The lifestyle blogosphere lit up with starry-eyed wonder. That comes from the article, The Secrets of Long Life and Anti-Aging, The Passing of Emma Morano at 117 Years Old, How Did She Do It? By Dr. Binoy Campmark, posted April 19th. The evidence surprisingly does point to a consistent pattern of Israeli state policy aims that has involved facilitating the emergence and the sustenance of militant Islamic organizations. In order to understand this phenomenon, it is important to be aware of the historical policies pursued by the state of Israel, which have been predicated on the idea of weakening its opponents in order to reduce external threats to its security. This feeds into an overarching goal of balkanizing Muslim Arab nations and the manipulation of tribal and sectarian rivalries within such polities as a means of achieving this end. It is while bearing this in mind that evidence of Israel's support of an Islamist militia during the Soviet-Afghan War, terror groups in Iran, a group of insurrectionists in Yemen and jihadist militias in the ongoing Syrian civil war becomes a phenomenon that is more readily comprehended. It also explains why Israel supplied weapons to Iran during its war with Iraq and why Israel effectively aided the creation of the Palestinian Islamist organization Hamas. That comes from the article, Israel and Islamist Militias, a Strange and Recurring Alliance, by Adiyinka Makinde, posted April 20th, originally appearing at adiyinkamakinde.blogspot.ca. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. I'm joined here by two friends and geopolitical and economic analysts who are going to help me parse through some of the major flashpoints around the globe at the moment and try to contextualize them in terms of some of the main forces driving the current state of affairs. So to my right, I'm joined by Radhika Desai. She is professor at the Department of Political Studies and Director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group, both based at the University of Manitoba. She's the author of a number of books, including Geopolitical Economy After U.S. Hegemony, Globalization and Empire from 2013. She's also the author of numerous articles in Economic and Political Weekly, New Left Review, Third World Quarterly and other journals, and in edited collections on parties, political economy, culture, and nationalism. She also co-edits with Alan Freeman the Geopolitical Economy book series with Manchester University Press and the Future of Capitalism book series with Pluto Press. And on my left, we are joined by Mahdi Darius Nazimroya. He's a sociologist, award-winning author, and geopolitical analyst who currently teaches at the University of the Philippines. He's the author of The Globalization of NATO. He's a research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization and a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica, a peer-reviewed journal of geopolitical science in Italy. So thank you both of you for joining us. I thought maybe we'd start our conversation with an examination of some of the tensions that are growing between the United States and China. There's been a lot of concern over the last month with regard to the South China Sea, where there's the Scarborough Shoal, which is basically being contested by the Philippines and China.
And so we've been seeing some interesting developments there. There's been, over the past year, U.S. maneuvers in that area. And so it looks as if there's some contentions growing there, although I understand that the President Duterte seems to be trying to diminish that rhetoric as they're trying to rebalance their economic and diplomatic imperatives. Although I understand, I think it was in March 20th, it was the one of the Philippine Supreme Court Justice Antonio Carpio intervened and proposed sending the Philippine Navy to patrol that area, and in the event of a Chinese attack, they could invoke the Philippine-U.S. Mutual Defense Treaty. So it looks like there's something growing there, and I wonder if you might be able to contextualize that for us. Mari, I know you've done a lot of research in that area. What are your thoughts as you look at that those developments in the South China Sea?
Well, I'd like to start off by saying that the situation is not black and white. Maybe that's a very simplistic way to start off, because the Chinese are being demonized. They're not at fault with many of the allegations being brought about against them. They're not guilty of those allegations. They're not totally clear either. There are nuances, I'd have to say. I want to start off by saying that, first of all, the issue of the South China Sea is politicized. If you look at the ownership, the legal issues, the geographic definitions, there's legal definitions involved here, it's much more complicated. First of all, we have to look back to at the Philippines as an American territory. The Spanish-American War, the Philippines was surrendered through the Treaty of Paris to the United States of America, as well as Puerto Rico, Cuba. The Spanish lost these possessions. So the Philippines turned from a Spanish colony to an American colony. This is very important because within the treaty, within the conditions of surrender of the transfer of the Philippines, there was geographic boundaries. The South China Sea, the islands there, are not in within those geographic boundaries. That's the first thing you have to take note of. The second thing you have to take note of is that when the Japanese annexed Taiwan, in the process, when the Japanese Empire annexed Taiwan, they took certain islands in the South China Sea. When they took these islands from the Chinese, they said this is part of the province of Taiwan, more or less. They said the Japanese who took these islands recognized the islands as Chinese territory in the South China Sea. The only countries that protested, aside from China, was France. And the reason was France said these were part of Vietnam. So the Vietnamese legal claim is based on that, on the claim that this was part of Vietnamese territory. And the Chinese had their claim. There was the United States, the State Department did not say anything about the issue. And in fact, when the Japanese surrendered, and there's a treaty that the United States helped broker between the Philippines and the Republic of China, which is now Taiwan, the Republic of China, China, which is Taiwan and Japan, when that treaty was negotiated, those islands are several, not all of them, are mentioned as being returned to China. And at the time, this was the nationalists. So there's this legal background. Where the Chinese are playing around is, we might critique the Chinese on the issue of the definitions of these land formations, rocks. The Chinese claim that some of them are different legal definitions. Basically, it's not a low altitude, it's not a low elevation, it's not a rock. The reason for that is because of the issue of adjacent waters and exclusive economic zone. So the Chinese want to claim as much as they can. And this is where the Philippines took them to court. That's what the court case was about. It wasn't about ownership. It was on the definitions, the geo-legal definitions of what those islands are. But to understand the Chinese position of why the Chinese are pushing for their interpretation of the geo-legal definitions of these islands is because the Chinese have security interests. First of all, this is the South China Sea is very important lifeline for Chinese trade and energy supplies. It always has been. The Pentagon actually is the one that coins the term string of pearls. It means Chinese bases in the Indian Ocean and West Pacific. The Chinese are setting up these string of pearls to protect their routes, the trade routes, like the Maritime Silk Road, which is coming into fruition, and to the energy corridors, aside from the land ones they're building now with Russia, Kazakhstan, and Central Asia. But so their interest is to say and claim as much of adjacent waters and exclusive economic zones as possible. And the United States is now, United States hasn't even signed the UN convention, the Law of the Seas. You know, it's accusing the Chinese of breaking it. And increasingly you have Japan, all these NATO members like France doing military exercises in the South China Sea, or several thousand ships go through there, and there hasn't been any real problem. Statistically, it's like 0.001, something like that, if you do the figures. Empirically, if you want to do the figures on how many problems there's been with China. In fact, one other thing I want to bring into account is that the Philippines once had a military conflict, small skirmish with somebody over these islands, but it was Vietnam, and actually it was South Vietnam, which was the ally of the Philippines and the United States over one of the islands. That's the only time there's been a really violent clash was between an ally of the Philippines, South Vietnam. And in fact, the most militarily aggressive country in the South China Sea is actually Vietnam, because it declares those area islands that it has under military administration. But we hear all about China. We don't hear about the Philippines' claim against Vietnam or Malaysia. The issue of the Taiwan and China is a little different. But
it's like you say, it's being politicized.
It's been politicized because the United States, first of all, wants to use that as an excuse to create a military cordon there.
That's that they have the Asia pivot.
This is just used to justify the Asia pivot, the militarization of that. The Americans are building bases in the Philippines right now as we speak, secretly in the South, Mindanao. The issue of terrorism in South Philippines has also helped with building these bases, which are against the constitution of the Philippines. They're against the constitution of the Philippines. And in fact, the group Abu Sayyaf, which is active in the Southern Philippines, was established when the Filipino Congress was against U.S. bases. You know, so there's a lot of other backstories to what's happening there.
Yeah, and just to maybe get back to that in a second. I wanted to get Radhika's perspective on this, because I mean, we all, you know, Madi just referenced the One Belt, One Road project and the naval aspect of it. And we've seen China being a growing power, and there's, you know, these new routes that will enhance that regional trade. And that's going up very much against U.S. You know, imperial or hegemonic interests. So I'm wondering if you can maybe you know, address that discussion a little bit, and how you see, you know, these developments in the South China Sea in an economic context.
Sure. Let me just begin by mentioning that the rising tensions in the South China Sea is part of a larger pattern, a pattern that you may say is kind of post-Cold War, or it's like a new Cold War pattern. Although I would also like to suggest that this has a much older provenance, in the sense that there is a certain dynamic of American actions over the last century or more, which explains all of this. Essentially, I would say that historically the United States has always tried to create a world in which its own corporations would have full freedom of movement, investment, trade, etc. And this requires, if this sort of world is to be realized, it requires the suppression of two different things, two different but related things. One is the assertion of the sovereignty of other countries, and the other is the ability of other countries to pursue forms of economic development which would go athwart the rights that the U.S. would like its own corporations to have. Now, I have to also say one other thing before we proceed further. The idea that the United States is hegemonic or imperial is certainly, I mean, it's been very prevalent and all that, but one has to remember that while this has been the project of the United States has not really succeeded in this. And in fact, that in the times in which we live now, it is definitely, its power is slipping away even faster than it was doing before. So this is the broader context. Now, this, if you see it in this context, and what you realize is that the pattern of demonization, whether it is of China or Russia, or Venezuela, the leaders of these countries, or in China's case, the country as a whole, this is a pattern of demonization which is precisely directed against leaders of countries that have tried to strike out on their own, trying to pursue a different form of economic development, and therefore, and which could also pose a challenge in China's case, and in the case partially of Russia, they also pose a challenge to the United States internationally. So this kind of demonization is routine, and it's very sad that the Western press largely follows the dictates. You know, we are often told that the press in China is not independent, it follows the government line. Well, look at our press. How free does it look to you? How independent does it look to you? So that's one thing. Now, the other thing I'd like to stress is to take off from something that that Madhi was saying. What's happening in the South China Sea should be understood in a larger context, where what China is trying to do is defend certain arrangements that are critical for it. Such a huge part of China's trade and energy supplies flow through those narrow straits that come off the South China Sea, that for China not to have some kind of control over what happens there is to actually subject itself to a wider world environment in which it has no control over what it most essentially needs to control. By contrast, the United States has a perception of its security interests, what you may call the forward security interest, where it needs to fight wars and raise tensions thousands of miles away from its own border. So the United States thinks it's perfectly legitimate for it to say its interests are being violated in the Middle East or in China or in Ukraine, which are thousands of miles away from where the US is, whereas Russia or China are defending their own interests within their own neighborhoods. This is what's happening. I'd also like to say a few other things that also put it in the context. We talked about the pivot to Asia. This was certainly part of Obama's policy. It was part of a policy in which it was the Obama administration's response to the realization that China's economic strength and therefore naturally its geopolitical and other strengths were rising, that the Chinese government was never going to be a kind of easy, they were never going to simply kowtow to American interests and the American line. So this was an independent power, which they could not really allow in a sense. And so the pivot to Asia was part of a military as well as commercial strategy to try to project American interest in that area. Now, the economic part of the strategy lies in tatters. The TPP is dead. In fact, even before the Trump administration finally said we are closing this whole initiative, in fact, it was not really, the TPP was not really such a powerful force against China. And there's one very, very simple reason. There's a new book that's coming out, the first one in our geopolitical economy book series, which is about China and its neighborhood and the new Cold War between the US and China. And what it shows very definitively, it's by Jude Woodward, who is a British scholar. And what Jude shows in this book is that what you you see when you examine China's neighborhood is that even countries that can occasionally be provoked by Western interests, particularly the United States, into taking some stances in opposition to China, actually are becoming so deeply integrated into the regional political economy, which is dominated by China, that they cannot in any systematic and sustained fashion and should not go against. And China is not an imperial power. China is simply creating a largely benign economic environment of dynamic economic growth in which these countries would be foolish not to participate. So that's the larger context. The economic strategy lies in tatters. So now what the US has remaining as the only option is to try and increase tensions between some of its traditional allies, such as the United States, or the Philippines is now teetering, tottering. Perhaps Mahdi will say a little bit more about how he sees Duterte's what exactly is the underlying pattern of Duterte's policies. But there's always Vietnam and so on. But in general, I would say that this ability to provoke tensions is not going to be very successful. I mean, take the example of Taiwan.
Well, I think if you look at right now, I mean, even just it seems as if the way the response, the players like Russia and China, as the United States moves forward, the reaction seems to be growing cohesion between Russia and China. Exactly. And Iran.
Exactly. And in fact, in many ways, the Americans are driving these countries together. The most recent country that it has driven in that direction is Turkey, which has, historically been an American ally. But given the manner in which the Americans have essentially reacted to certain key initiatives by the Erdogan regime, and it would seem also participated in an attempt to destabilize that government, it would seem that Turkey is going to go in that direction as well. So what the United States would love to do is to divorce China from the ever closer embrace in which it is coming with its own neighbors, but this is not going to be particularly successful. And one final point I'd like to make is that in this context, especially with the Trump administration going out of its way to alienate its European allies, it would seem that Europe is also standing at a kind of crossroads where Europe's own reaction to the Ukraine crisis and other flashpoints has been relatively independent, and every so often the United States tries to cow Europe into agreeing to it. But remember, if there were to be a war in these theaters, Europe would be very directly affected. The European economy is also reliant on Russian energy supplies and so on. So they have a direct interest in not antagonizing the Russians to such an extent, even though they are capitalist countries and they may not, they may have differences with Russia. They would rather manage these differences in a different way than the Americans. Oh, and one final point, sorry. I think that in this context, the United States policies cannot be fully understood, what it's trying to do and so on, unless you realize one other thing about the United States, and that is that in the context of malingering economy, the American military industrial complex is a very powerful entity, both in terms of its importance in economic importance, as a share of the product of US GDP and US exports in particular, but then another sense in the extent of its political influence. I think that in many ways, the belligerence that you have seen in the United States, much of which has not resulted in any net gains for US or its corporations, except in the sense that they create a lot of money for American defense corporations. Yeah,
the military industrial media complex.
Yes. And so you have to also understand that a good part of what's happening in the United States and a good part of American policymaking cannot be understood unless you understand that there is a kind of military industrial complex tail wagging the American policy and economic dog.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Madi, I wanted to, earlier we were hearing what Radhika was saying about these vital roots that were critical for China. I was also reminded of another very critical route, and that was the one that's that brings us to another flashpoint of Yemen. There's that Strait of Bab al-Mandab, which is so strategic. That's through which 40% of oil is shipped, and this is I think part, as I see it, it's part of a major trade route, in addition to the whole, New Silk Road, One Belt, One Road. There's this, that too is a very critical route, in terms of, and that very much binds Europe, close to Asia. And so what we're seeing right now in Yemen, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's largely about maintaining that, Western U.S. control of that critical area. And so we see the Gulf states, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, all those real, democracy-minded countries intervening to protect the, to restore the former president to his, against these Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. So anyway, that's, how do you, look, when you look at that particular region, when you look at Yemen, what stands out for you?
Okay, well, first we should clear some issues about the Gate of Tears, as it's called in English. That's the English name for it. The first thing we should talk about in Yemen is that the president that was supposedly removed, al-Hadi, had passed his term. There was nothing unconstitutional. They were trying to keep him in place, and they were trying to force something unconstitutional on various groups, so-called Iranian-backed groups. They're not all Iranian-backed, actually. And second thing is, what's happening in Yemen is not an issue of Shiite Muslims versus Sunni Muslims, because they're, both sides are mixed. And in fact, the so-called Houthi were actually supported by Saudi Arabia. During the civil war against the predecessors to the Houthis, which wanted an imamate in Yemen, who fought the Marxists and the nationalists, were supported by Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Britain during the civil war in Yemen. There was two Yemens at the time. So we'll make that clear. The Houthi worked with the Saudis. It's only later on that there was differences, and the problems that emerged in Yemen, there's the Arabian dimension to it, which has to do with some of Saudi Arabia's interests, but there are also the broader interests, which you touched upon. It's the Gate of Tears, shipping that goes through there. I would say it connects Asia to Europe, Europe to Asia. It's not one way. It's both ways. The Suez Canal is useless without that strait. The Suez Canal is at the northern side of the Red Sea, connects the Mediterranean to the Red Sea, and that strait connects the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea, and the broader Indian Ocean. So one thing that both the Russians, the Iranians, actually all three of them, not two, the Russians, the Iranians, and the Chinese are aware of is that in American policy, controlling that strait, the U.S. has two initiatives. We control Syria and we control Yemen, then we can attack Iran. That's an American objective. I'm not saying they're going to attack Iran, but for the United States, prerequisites to a war with Iran include controlling that strait and removing Syria from its alliance with Iran, or neutralizing Syria. So the Russians and the Iranians and their strategists are very aware of this. The other factor is also the United States wants to control choke points around the world. Choke points are like the Bosphorus, where Istanbul is between Europe and Asia, the Red Sea, the Straits of Hormuz, the Straits of Malacca. This is why Russian, Iranian, Chinese, as well as Indian, and before Euromaidan, Ukrainian naval ships were all stationed there. The Iranians actually just recently, an admiral and a military commander in the Iranian armed forces have declared that they would like to see an Iranian permanent naval presence there. through a base in Yemen eventually, as well as in Syria. And those are based on their interests. So it's no coincidence that also you mentioned these Arabian states, these Gulf GCC, Gulf Cooperation Country states, council states. But NATO is there too. In fact, the French have traditionally have a base in Djibouti. An American base now exists there, and NATO basically acts out of there. The European Union has extended its maritime naval presence also, which is interlocked with NATO and the United States to a degree. There's nuances. But so everybody is there. And one of the reasons is to control this strait. I want to jump back to something that Radhika said, that there's an older dynamics are involved, larger patterns. That's totally correct. The U.S. policy before the end of the Second World War was they adopted British strategic policies. And as later on, they'll also adopt German strategic planning incorporated. But one of them is to control the areas called the Rimland, around the Eurasian heartland. This is part of that Rimland. This Rimland area, the Americans say this is what will make, American strategists believe, will make or break our strategy. So even the pivot to the Asia Pacific is not new. It's pretty old. It started when the United States takes the Philippines, and the United States actually signed made an agreement with the Japanese. They told the Japanese, you guys can take Korea, and we will take the Philippines. So it's a very old strategy. If you look at it, who accepts the division of, who helps break up China more or less? China has been divided, Taiwan and China. Who supported this type of breakup? That focus in that region. I mean, the American policy before the end of World War II and at the end of World War II, as articulated by Nicholas Spykman, is that there should be no dominant power uniting the countries of Asia or Europe. That's their policy. And in fact, this their failed economic free trade zones, you know, the one in Europe and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they more or less want to connect the Asia-Pacific countries to the United States and the European Union countries to the United States at the expense of who? Russia and China. You know, that's why they're trying to turn all their neighbors against them. So there is an older dynamic, I think. And the last point, just to even reinforce what I'm saying, is during the Cold War, NATO had a sister alliance. It was called the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. It is part of this military move. There's NATO in Europe and the Mediterranean area, and in Southeast Asia they had CETO, Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, and they even made interlocks. France, Britain, and the United States, who are members of this alliance, were also members of NATO. Pakistan, which was a member of this alliance, was also a member of CETO. The Central Treaty Organization, or the Baghdad Pact, which also included Britain and Turkey. So this entire part of Europe and Asia surrounded by a belt of American alliances, it's old. It's an old policy of isolating dominant countries in Eurasia.
I want to move on to one more topic. I think we have time for one more topic. I wanted to get into the French elections and the prospects of wither the European Union, because we saw the way things played out in Great Britain with Brexit. Now you've got this Marie Le Pen, who's very anti-EU, appearing to be in a context with the pro-EU candidate Macron, and it seems to reflect strong anti-EU sentiment throughout France. So if we see France going in that same direction as Great Britain, and in a certain sense the United States with Trump, what happens to the European Union, and what happens to what does that mean in the larger economic context?
Okay. I think that there is certainly one thing that unites all the three phenomena you spoke of: Trump, Le Pen, and Brexit, and that is that they're all reactions to neoliberalism. However, of course, they're all also very different. I mean, the United States, what happened, the election of Trump is its own homegrown thing, and I would say that the deficiencies of the Democratic Party were as much at fault in bringing Trump to power as Trump's own efforts were successful at bringing himself to power.
And Bernie Sanders was running on a sort of, in
Bernie
some
Sanders
sense,
was I think Bernie
it was a different
Sanders
reaction to neoliberalism.
Was definitely a breath of fresh air and a very hopeful development. But of course, there were two different things I would say that were problematic still, although it was still a step forward. But I would say there were two major limitations of the Sanders campaign that one should always remember. One was his inability to really break the hold of the Democratic establishment on the black sections of the Democratic Party, which are highly organized forms of support and co-optation. And the second is, of course, he said very little about America's foreign policy, which is really critical. You cannot understand why American people are suffering today if you don't understand the broader political economy of corporate power, of which military industrial complex corporation power is one element, but the other is also that the other corporations are also interested in essentially trying to expand the range of their activity abroad precisely by demonizing, marginalizing, and actually engaging in a threatening or actual war activities against governments that have a different conception of the organization of economic life from American corporations. So anyhow, but that's
looking at European Union.
If we go to the European Union, I think that there's one thing to understand. First of all, if France does leave, I think it will really there will be no European Union unless you count what will remain of the European Union will be so different. It'll essentially be a union of the German core and the southern and western southern and eastern peripheries, which especially the eastern periphery has essentially been transformed into a kind of a sort of a holding cell for reserve labor for the Western European economy. And this is the secondary status to which all these Eastern European countries have been subject. So if France leaves, that's what's going to happen.
I wonder what that means as an economic this is unprecedented since the Second World War.
Yes, I think that, okay, so I just want to say one other thing and then I want to come back to that longer term perspective. So, but if France leaves, it's also very different from Brexit because remember, Britain always had a one foot in, one foot out a policy vis-a-vis the European Union. It didn't sign the social chapter. It was not part of the euro. It did not accept many of the social obligations of the European Union. So in Britain, the neoliberalism to which the British people were reacting as a largely homegrown affair, and it has a lot to do with the financial power of the financial interest centered in London. In the EU, the French people are now reacting against the neoliberalism of which the EU is the policeman. The EU imposes neoliberalism as a matter of policy, as a matter of agreed policy on the rest of the European Union, and since the beginning of this century, this neoliberalism has become much more much harsher, and that has been accompanied by a very problematic development, which is the financialization of the West European economy, the continental West European economy, which until then had remained largely focused on the productive economy. So I think that this has definitely been a regressive development, but I don't see.
Financialization, you're basically talking about investments and money making money as opposed to making things.
Yes, exactly. The financialization of works usually against the productive economy in a number of different ways. And the problem is that I don't see Mrs. Merkel as presenting any kind of an alternative to this that will be a pole of attraction to those who are repelled by Marine Le Pen and her albeit slightly more sophisticated, but still very racist policies, you know, more sophisticated than her father, but still fairly racist policies. So I think that the other people need a pole of attraction, and that pole of attraction cannot be constituted without an economic vision of how you're going to reorganize the productive economy of Western Europe on a more productive and more egalitarian basis. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's what's at stake there. And it's interesting that the discussions around Brexit and so on have also provoked, and generally post 2008 politics in the UK has also provoked this new discussions about having industrial policies and so on in the UK. And I think that Germany also needs to go back to those roots of having a very productive economy-centered set of economic policies, which at the moment, at least, it doesn't seem to be able to do. So, yeah, we'll just have to see what happens.
Madi, I was wondering if you have any thoughts about these developments, a potential shift into an axis around that German economic hub, I guess you may call it.
Well, Germany is increasingly becoming the core of the European Union. I mean, what we saw in Greece, Spain, you can see there's the German influence is very strong in those events. What I'd like to say from a different dimension, a different angle to this is Brexit, this rise of reactionary conservatism in Europe. It's a reaction, of course, to neoliberal policies and to the straitjacket, to the EU. You know, it's very, maybe I could use the Weberian term from Max Weber about the shrinking shell or the iron cage, as it was mistranslated into English, it's the EU is that bureaucratic straitjacket, which is taking it claims to be very democratic, and the supporters of the European Union, like EU officials that you'll meet, EU officials that I've talked to, believe that the European Union is the epitome, the highest apex of the civilized human world. You know, they really strongly believe that. But I think the reaction in these countries is to this hegemony of the European Union telling them this is defining what life should be about in all aspects. I mean, from the governmental to the educational, the standardization that forgets about local contexts many times too. I mean, maybe this is a sociological analysis of it, but there's a reaction. And of course, think of all the past decades, how many times that people in the Netherlands, Ireland, all these states vote against the EU, but it still goes ahead, this so-called democratic body. So that's the point I want to make. And that's why to an extent, you see what's happening in France. The sad part about this is they're looking at it in cultural terms and blaming, you know, the immigrants, migrants, newcomers. Maybe this is trivia again, but I'd like to refer you this conversation, take it back to 2011-2012. The patriarch of the Maronite Catholic Church, he met with Nicolas Sarkozy, Monsieur Sarkozy, president of France at the time, and he said, you know, you guys are supporting these events in Syria, but it's going to lead to massive waves of immigration, people leaving, fleeing the country. He said this. Sarkozy said the European Union, more or less, you can look this up to verify. He said that we are prepared for who's going to come to Europe. They didn't say all the people. Sarkozy said the Christians. So they were ready for an exodus. That the conversation was based around this so-called exodus. So I know they knew these things were going to happen. But the point is, regardless of that, is that the blame is being put on migrants, which is not really an issue. Europe needs migrants economically. It's really what is called a red herring. You know, about it's the real problems within Europe are the decay, the economic policies, the privatization of state infrastructure, the takeover of other states' infrastructure, national infrastructure, by German corporations and other countries in that economic core. Those are the problems, not people coming in from Syria. You know.
I wanted to maybe, Radhika, maybe if you have some final thoughts before we close.
I'd like to make two points. I think that Mahdi's absolutely right to point out how the problems of Europe are being wrongly blamed on migrants. And I would like to suggest that the way to think about this is very simple. First of all, Western economies always engage in a discourse about how migrants are beating down their doors in order to get there. But in reality, Western economies need migrants. They invite migrants. They clearly lay out the paths along which migrants should come. The migrants, the huge refugee influx into Europe did not occur until Mrs. Merkel said, "We will accept 1 million Syrians." That's what she said. That was Europe and Sarkozy, you know, in the days of Merkozy, I suppose, they came up with this view that we need more Middle Eastern migrants. They are relatively from, you know, relatively well-off, sophisticated, well-educated societies and so on. So we are going to take these people. We need them. Capitalist, the managers of capitalist economies constantly need migrants in order to loosen up the labor market. At the same time, the loosening of the labor market is more effective when you keep up a high decibel a rhetoric against migration, because what that does is it ghettoizes migrants into these relatively ill-paid ghettos and so on, keeps them under constantly under threat, so that it creates a pressurized labor force, and therefore then their existence then divides the labor movement. It does all of these things, and unfortunately, the leaders of the left are not generally uniformly being able to see this. Is that? In fact, capitalism cannot operate without huge amounts of migration. It has historically been so. Originally, it took place between countryside into towns, and now it simply happens to cross borders. The effect is the same. The needs are the same. The structural needs are the same. So I think that European countries have deliberately taken in these migrants. And yes, they suffer from high levels of unemployment, but that's not the issue. The issue is that they want people who are willing to work for even less money.
Not unlike the Mexican migrating to the U.S.
This is for all Western countries. I want to make one final point, which is basically that today part of the revolt against neoliberalism is taking place because neoliberalism and financialization have created a type of economy in which which is unable to provide decent jobs. The only jobs it has is a small number of good jobs for overworked people who are working at the upper levels of the professions, and then crappy jobs, McJobs for everybody else. And if this is the kind of economy that neoliberalism creates, of course it's going to create huge amounts of dissatisfaction against it. So this is on the one hand happening. On the other hand, precisely those forces who are creating a different type of economy, who appear to be capable of producing economies with greater dynamism, are being demonized. China is the first in this context, but also other countries like Venezuela under Maduro and Chavez or Russia are being demonized precisely because in important ways they represent, even though they may not be succeeding as well as China, they represent attempts to move in a different direction. So to come back to China, I'd like to make one other point, which is that at the moment the world is also poised on the knife edge between two very different options. On the one hand, of options for development for many countries. So on the one hand, you have the U.S.-centered, dollar-denominated world international financial system in which people are supposed to lay open, you know, lift capital controls, lay open their economies to inflows and outflows of capital. But they are told that if they do this, they will get productive capital. No such thing happens. Capital lifting of capital controls simply leads to the influx of short-term money, whose reflux then creates all sorts of banking and currency crises and so on and so forth. On the other hand, China, especially with the Asian infrastructure development, with the One Belt, One Road policy, etc., it is at one stroke using its now vast stock of financial power in order to killed several birds with one stone. One is China's own western part is relatively less developed, and these initiatives are actually going to create a huge amount of development in the western part of China. Secondly, it's going to bring into its fold, in a sense, and this fold is that of a managed economy, not an economy that is ruled by mysterious and usually volatile and destructive capitalist forces, but at least that you can manage it. Anyway, it bring into its fold powers further to the west of it, all the way up to and including Russia and even Europe. And Europe is not immune to the charms of China on this matter. So the kind of long-term capital they are giving, the kind of developmental investments they are making, and they are doing this in a spirit of cooperation rather than going to war. How many wars has China set off in this very, very transformative process through which it has arisen? You know, in recent years...
It's sort of like attracting, do better attracting with honey than with vinegar kind of approach.
I think, and the Chinese generally understand that. It's interesting to know that very often I didn't know this, that about the Vietnamese border being a colonial border, which is now being claimed by Vietnam, but the dispute between India and China, India is in the same position. It's claiming a colonial border rather than trying to settle the issue rationally, and China's position is a lot more rational. But I think that the world has been capitalist, broadly speaking. The dominant powers of the world have been capitalist for more than 200 years now. In this process, we have seen a very long process through which new capitalist powers or non-capitalist powers like the Soviet Union and China and so on have emerged, and they have all had one thing in common, whether communist or capitalist. They have had a very high degree of state intervention in order to bring their economy up to a competitive and level, which has been critical for their development. And so it is this process that has spread productive capacity beyond the northwestern core of Europe where capitalism began. So that's what began to develop productive capacity in countries like Germany, Japan, and the United States, later on in the Soviet Union, then in a multitude of developing countries, and so on. So this has always been, so in a sense, historically, the core capitalist powers powers have actually decreased, yeah, and productive capacity has spread. Now, more recently, with the rise of China in particular, people have been starting to talk about the Thucydides trap. That is to say, in the Peloponnesian War, he narrates a story of how the rise of Athens threatened Sparta, etc., etc. And this, in one way, is a good analogy. But there is another point, which is that by invoking this, what some people are trying to do is naturalize the idea that the dominant power should feel threatened by the rise of new powers. But actually, the dominant power, it is the responsibility of the dominant power in an age of transformation to accommodate the rise, peacefully accommodate it. It is the unwillingness of the West to peacefully accommodate the rise of China and other powers that is actually creating a lot of these flashpoints. I think this is the key point of our time. And I think that I don't see, despite the demonization of the Putins and the Chavezes and the Maduros and the Chinese governments and Communist Party, despite all these things, the evidence is very much in favor of, evidence is very much on the side, on the interpretation, or supports the interpretation that it is the West which seems to be unwilling to accommodate peacefully.
That's leading to its own
and
downfall.
That is what is leading to rising tensions and these flashpoints that we have been discussing around the world.
Okay, I want to thank both of you for participating in this very expansive conversation about the current world situation. These are interesting times. And,
thank you, Michael. It was a pleasure. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madi. Thank you very much, Radhika Desai. And thank you for joining us for this discussion. And we'll have more on the Global Research News Hour radio program in coming weeks. Thank you very much for joining us. That conversation with Radhika Desai and Madi Nazim Roya was conducted at the University of Winnipeg on April 1st, 2017, 3 days before the suspected chemical weapons attack on a town in the Idlib province of Syria, which allegedly compelled U.S. President Donald Trump to authorize the launching of 59 Tomahawk missiles on the Al-Sherat airbase. On next week's program, we will challenge the official account of these events and their fallout. What does the Trump administration's about-face on Syria mean for the region and the world? Find out in 7 days.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.